And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
You may not know this, but you're one of the largest landowners in the world. That's true even if you don't own your own home. You see, if you're a citizen of the United States, you are one of the owners of over 600 million acres of public lands. That comes to 2 acres for every one of the 302,857,725 people in the United States alive today. You own and have access to over one-third of all the land in the United States. Every time you visit a national, state, or local park, you are on your land. And as any landowner knows, with ownership comes responsibility. Today, we remind you that in 2 weeks, it's time to help maintain your property. It's National Public Lands Day, when your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We've got so much to be proud of in America. Much of it comes from the inheritance of greatness that was born with the birth of America. A government of, by, and for the people has served us well for hundreds of years. We seem to struggle each day right now, it seems, to see if we'll be able to survive the next 100 years. This concept of the common good, the common will, was also expressed in the common lands. And whether we know it or not, we are blessed each day by our public lands. Many are well known, our legacy of protecting our greatest wonders enshrined in our national parks. We've added seashores, national wildlife refuges, wilderness areas, national forests and monuments, lakes and seashores, caves, marine sanctuaries, historic sites, and scenic trails, grasslands, and even now, vistas. Some argue that far too much of our land is held in trust and would be better off turned over to development and more profitable use. But this we know, that once we divest ourselves of our public lands, they will never be returned to the people. We can discuss the values of public lands at another time. And there are some interesting trends that we'll be talking about soon in the designation of wilderness areas. But today, we want to talk about the 2007 National Public Lands Day events coming up September 29th. In segment 2 of today's show, we'll be talking with a few of the people who are organizing one of the nation's largest volunteer efforts that each year brings over 100,000 people out to help maintain and study and learn about and enjoy their public lands, your public lands. That will be preceded by the Nature News, but now it's time for the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and I have a special announcement about our future Weekly Earth Summits. I'm opening up participation here at the microphone to you, all of you who listen and have thoughts, ideas, events to talk about, and observations that you'd like to share. We try to limit each speaker to not more than 3 minutes, so at the end of today's briefing, I'll tell you how to contact me to share your voice on the Weekly Earth Summit. I look forward to hearing from you. So, let's get started with today's Weekly Earth Summit. Reports keep coming in that confirm that we're witnessing a serious increase in the number of species that are becoming extinct or face extinction. A report this week talked about the effect the Ebola virus is having on the gorilla populations. These are very serious times for some of the world's most extraordinary creatures. Now, Jeff Miller of the Center for Biological Diversity adds a personal perspective on the increasing number of endangered species. Jeff?
The message I always give people is, you know, I'm often asked, you know, we advocate for a lot of the unloved and unknown species. That's kind of been our trademark. I mean, you know, beetles and butterflies and coral species and, you know, some very obscure species, but that are important nonetheless and that are indicative of you know, their decline is indicative of problems with the health of ecosystems. And people often ask, well, why should I care if, you know, one little subspecies of frog goes extinct or if that lizard is no longer around? And, you know, ultimately it gets down to, you know, it's a moral and a philosophical issue, which is, you know, we humans are responsible for the changes in the habitat degradation that is driving these species extinct, and I think we have an obligation to do everything we can to protect these species and prevent them from going extinct. But just on a selfish worldview, you know, these species are the canary in the coal mine, and you know, when something starts to happen, you know, for example, a third of the world's amphibian species are in danger of extinction, and the extinctions are happening incredibly quickly, and that should be cause for concern for us, and essentially, ultimately, we're in line for the same fate if we don't make sure we have a healthy functioning planet.
Thanks, Jeff. Dave Foreman also weighs in on the issue of the disappearance of the wild. Dave?
For over 25 centuries, the written record carries descriptions of damage wrought by too many people, and the worries of wise people about the consequences of human population growth. I think a careful search would find such writings even earlier. Had we the tools and could find the artifacts, we might find like descriptions and worries another 15 or more centuries back, even into the Neolithic, certainly so in the New World. Consequences of human overpopulation during both historic and prehistoric times can be sorted into five kinds. 1, land abuse and loss of productivity. 2, depletion of necessary natural resources and conflict over obtaining new sources. 3, inability to grow enough food, leading to hunger and famine. 4, social, economic, and security crises and threats leading to warfare and intergroup strife. 5, harm to wild nature, including extinction of species. Only 10 years ago, when the Wildlands Project began to look at the kinds of ecological wounds causing mass extinction, we didn't see global heating as a big enough deal for it to be one of the wounds. Unbelievable levels of extinction were happening because of direct killing, habitat destruction, fragmentation, loss of evolutionary and ecological processes, invasion by exotic species and diseases, and biocide pollution. But now, we know that the greenhouse effect may become the major cause of species extinction in the coming century. This knowledge has rocked me back on my heels. It has smacked me in the face like a meteor out of the dark. In some ways, it is too hellish to behold. But it is the real world, muchachos, and we are in it. We need to speak out loud and clear as conservationists that it is the human population explosion that has driven industrialization the last 200 years, thereby causing the greenhouse effect. And as conservationists, we must be loud and clear that the human population explosion and catastrophic global heating will cause mass extinction.
Dave is a co-founder of the Rewilding Institute. Carl Pope, president of the Sierra Club, is noting certain disappearances as well and shares his take on our future. Carl?
Well, Karl Rove is gone. Attorney General Gonzalez, Gail Norton too. But much as environmentalists welcome their departure, there's much less solace than you might think. Our biggest problem remains. Vice President Cheney has driven the administration's war on the land and water. He forced out Christy Todd Whitman at EPA, sold out salmon fishermen on the Klamath River, blocked efforts to modernize America's electrical grid. Rove may have come up with the cute names, healthy forests and clear skies, but Cheney wrote the policies. And he's still doing it. Even as public opinion numbers for the administration collapse, congressional Republicans become restive, and federal courts repeatedly slap the administration down, Dick is staying the course. The BLM recently proposed to increase old-growth logging sevenfold. New forest rules suggest that Cheney thinks the national forests themselves are an undisclosed secret location, which has to be kept a secret from the American people. Republican hunters and anglers in Wyoming had to sue to protect their wild lands from thousands of new oil and gas leases. A year after Katrina, the Army Corps of Engineers still won't protect the wetlands that are New Orleans' true security. It took a congressional hearing to get FEMA to stop selling toxic trailers to poison unknowing families. The federal courts and Congress are going to be very busy now that Dick Cheney stands alone.
Thanks, Carl. The science of animal behavior is reaching new levels of perception that advance the scientific basis for caring for animals, which share this earth with we human species. Ethologist and author Dr. Mark Beckhoff brings us up to date on recent discoveries that speak to this issue. Dr. Beckhoff.
There was an essay in Time magazine back in January, which was, you know, basically one of the clearest reviews of what we're learning in neurobiology and behavior. They said that mirror neurons will do for psychology what DNA did for molecular biology. And what they were saying was that it's very important to recognize that there are ways now where animals can share emotions and share intention. So the way it might work would be, when I do a play bow, my play bow neurons fire, and I know what I feel. When you do a play bow, my mirror neurons for play bow fire, and I have an idea of what you feel and what you want. There's a sharing of intention. There's this knowledge of what's in your head. And so, once again, when I say I can feel the pain of a dog, I can. And it's probably mediated by some system like mirror neurons. If I say I feel your pain, I feel your joy, I feel your grief, there's a neural or material basis. So what the discovery of mirror neurons has done across the board is it's really taken into the realm of science the notion of empathy, the sharing of feelings. These mirror neurons are sort of portals of empathy. That's really a great way to put it. That's, of course, what probably underlies the empathy in mice. So, you know, once again, if we have mirror neurons and great apes have mirror neurons and monkeys have mirror neurons, so do dogs, cats, and rats have a functional equivalent, just like the spindle cells that were thought to be only in humans and great apes are now for sure in whales, and I'll bet you if we look for them in other species, we'll find them.
Thanks, Dr. Beckhoff. It's no secret that we are in the throes of change on the Earth. Over the past 40 or so years, we achieved the modern age, which allows us to enjoy the literal fruits and vegetables of our labors and the labors of others from all over the planet. But this benefit of globalization has its downside. Brita Belli, managing editor of E! Magazine, shares her perspective on the importance of locally grown food. Brita?
Most of our food that we see now in the supermarkets is coming from all over the world. And the average produce that we would purchase travels between 1,500 and 2,500 miles to reach us. And so, I mean, I think that's something that we have to start thinking seriously about is this a system that we want to support? It especially becomes a bit bizarre when we have the same produce that could easily be grown in our own communities or be purchased in our own communities, and we're instead buying it from, you know, it's been shipped from South America, it's been shipped from Chile, you know. It is something I think consumers have to begin to think about is sort of the global repercussions of these choices. The majority of Midwest farms today are devoted to corn and soybeans, and a lot of our products are that we see, you know, all these kind of packaged foods and processed foods are made with corn syrup and partially hydrogenated corn oil and all this. We've kind of become a corn-based economy here, and instead are importing a lot of our other fresh produce and fruits and vegetables. This model has just become very heavily established, and it's going to be very difficult for us to really change that and to go back to small farming and to support small farms. But I think that's the impetus here, is that it's possible to start choosing local food again and to start supporting small farmers so that that can be a real part of the economy again.
Thanks, Brita. And now it's your chance to join us here at the podium to share your thoughts. We're expanding the speakers list to include all of you who are working, researching, directing, and writing about issues relevant to the future of life on Earth. The magic of the weekly Earth Summit comes from the combining of different thoughts and topics into this timely and articulate update on the planet. If you have something to share here on the weekly Earth Summit, I invite you to contact me by email. Include your name and phone number, and I'll pick up the phone and call you. You don't even have to summarize what it is you want to talk about. That's often the stumbling block that keeps people from actually doing something. When I get your email, I'll call you and we'll talk. And if it seems relevant to this forum, we'll set up a time for me to record you by phone. I have a way of pulling information out of people, so don't feel you need to finally craft your message. But of course, if you feel more comfortable, you can have it written down. I try to limit each speaker's comments to no more than 3 minutes, which is actually plenty of time to share your thoughts. So I'm inviting you to send an email to me with your name and phone number. That's all it takes. Send it to wildsidenews@cox.net. That's WILDSIDENEWS at COX.net. You can be part of the Voice of the Earth here on the Weekly Earth Summit. In just a moment, we fill you in on the upcoming National Public Lands Day and how you can be part of one of the nation's largest volunteer events. That's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Ready to get down and dirty to help keep America beautiful? Bring family and friends out to clean and restore America's parks, rivers, and trails on National Public Lands Day, Saturday, September 29th. Meet up with over 100,000 volunteers coast to coast and lend your helping hands for America's lands. Make it a date. For information on volunteer efforts in your area, visit www.publiclandsday.org. A message from the National Environmental Education Foundation.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
In just a moment, we talk with some of the people who are leading some very interesting events on National Public Lands Day when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Get your hands dirty to keep America beautiful. Come outdoors this National Public Lands Day, Saturday, September 29th. Help clean and restore America's parks, rivers, and trails. Meet up with over 100,000 other volunteers for America's lands by visiting publiclandsday.org. A message from the National Environmental Education Foundation.
You know, I don't have to convince you, one of the great listeners to the Wild Side News, about the importance of public lands. I know that you value the wonders of our national parks, that you've spent time on one of the national rivers or walking along a national seashore. America's commitment to a democratic society that serves the people has never been more faithfully executed than in the preservation of wilderness, the restoration of our national historic sites. It's an amazing public lands legacy we share. We'll be talking with people who have some very special opportunities for you on this upcoming National Public Lands Day, and we'll hear from them following today's Nature News. So first, the news. Like with any codependent relationship, there are some good weeks and some bad weeks. So it is with oil prices these days. There's plenty of ups and downs. Recently, people have been in love with the lowered prices of gas at the pumps, but prices have taken a turn for the worst in the last few weeks, but that may be just a warning of things to come. There was probably a day of celebration somewhere on the planet as oil prices reached an all-time high of $80+ a barrel, but for the rest of the billions of people on Earth, the moans and groans are yet to be heard, as this record price has not yet been felt. Be patient. It's coming. And speaking of records, a record number of species were added to the global database of threatened species. Nearly 200 animals and plants have been added this year, but experts say this is really just a small portion of those that are actually disappearing. From the lowland gorillas of Africa to corals of the Galapagos, more than 16,300 species are threatened with extinction. It's no secret that humans are very much involved in these new figures. Estimates of current extinction rates are at least 100 to 1,000 times higher than natural background rates. Julia Martin Lefevre, the Director General of the World Conservation Union, noted that the rate of biodiversity loss is increasing and we need to act now to significantly reduce it and stave off this global extinction crisis. With estimates of the number of species varying between 10 million and 100 million, it tells us we don't know much at all about the real nature of nature. What we do know is that it is all interconnected, and the domino theory may begin soon. Good news, bad news. The bad news first. Global warming is reducing the ice cover over the Arctic. The good news is it's opening up vast stretches of otherwise unchartable waters to exploration. The bad news is that the Arctic is becoming a battleground of competing interests to find and exploit these pristine areas. The good news is that they may find oil, gas, and other valuable resources. The bad news is that they may find oil, gas, and other valuable resources. The good news is that because of limited resources, people have become devoted to a sustainable future. The bad news is that the promise of new oil resources could weaken our will to achieve energy independence just as soon as possible. And on a final good news note, humans just may have the 100th monkey of understanding that we can learn to make a better world. Some more good news. Disappointing sales of whale meat from last year's resumption of whaling by Iceland has prompted the country's fisheries minister to stop issuing new whale hunting quotas until market demand increases. And on a confusing bit of news, one of the great success stories of the ocean, the return of the Pacific gray whale, may have been based on a miscalculation, scientists reported Monday in a study based on whale genetics. What was assumed to be a thriving whale population actually is, at times, starving from a dwindling food supply. Global warming is suspected to be a critical factor. The confusion comes from underestimating the pre-industrial populations of the Pacific gray whale at 20 to 30,000 worldwide. Recent estimates conclude, however, that the number should be more like 100,000. Therefore, the magnitude of the collapse is exponentially higher than had otherwise been concluded. Which is to say that, like gorillas and corals and rhinos and leopards, if these things matter, we must wake up. and in an unusual turn of events. This past week, a shark spotted swimming in the waters of Coney Island would normally result in a panic to clear the waters. But in an unusual twist, a lifeguard had to come to the rescue of a 2-foot-long sand shark as a mob of 75 to 100 people attacked the little guy, encircling it, holding it, and smacking it in the face. Marius Marinescu, the lifeguard that came to rescue the shark from the swimmer, said, "I wasn't going to let them hurt the poor thing." He carried the shark, a baby, and harmless to humans, to a less populated area and released it. And that's the news. Coming up Saturday, September 29th, is National Public Lands Day. It's one of the largest volunteer events in the country. The numbers of people who participate keeps growing, with over 100,000 people visiting one of their favorite public land sites to learn, to celebrate, to head on out on a trail and fix up the rough spots, repair bridges, clear brush. You can find out about the hundreds of events scheduled in every state in the nation by going to www.publiclandsday.org. That's publiclandsday.org. One of the unique things about National Public Lands Day is that there are some amazing opportunities to do some very interesting things with some fascinating people. And that's what we're going to do today, as we invite you to learn about some exciting events that are part of the National Public Lands Day coming up this September 29th. We'll be traveling to just 3 sites today. I think you'll find some similarly interesting events somewhere near you. So first, we're heading out to the lonesome wonders of the vast lands east of Bakersfield, California. There's so many interesting things one can do on National Public Lands Day, and so we're doing just a little survey of a few events to give you an idea of what you can do, and you can get out. This is really a fun opportunity. If you're sitting around too much, you find yourself, as I unfortunately do, I should be getting out more. That's just the truth. And the National Public Lands Day is a perfect time because there's so many interesting things to do. An interesting event that's happening on National Public Lands Day, September 29th, is happening in an area around China Lake, California, which is kind of in the middle of the desert, past Bakersfield. And to talk about what's happening there, is we're now talking with Russell Caldenberg. Russell, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, Russell, you kind of take public lands and stretch it into an area that a lot of people may not be familiar with. Why don't you talk a little bit about your site and why it's a public land, and then also what you plan to do on Saturday coming up.
You bet. Yeah, our site's in the middle of Mojave Desert at about 5,000 feet elevation on the north range of China Lake Naval Air Weapons Station, which is a research facility of encompassing 1.1 million acres between Barstow and Bishop, California, east of the Sierra Nevada and west of Death Valley. The area has been used for thousands of years by Indian people, those that came in early to chase mammoths and mastodons around the lakes that finally dried up, to the early pioneers, including the Death Valley 49ers, who went from Death Valley, across Panamint Valley, across the Argus Range, over China Lake, down into Los Angeles. It was the hotbed of early gold discovery, in basically from 1850 to the Depression era, and one of the places we have on the station, not China Lake Naval Air Weapons Station, is a little village site built of stone structures called Coso Village, that's C-O-C-O. It's hidden in the Coso Mountains, away from public view, and it's been there since at least 1860, probably earlier, probably Mexican miners were there about the time that Mexico was overcome by California and became the United States. And we plan to do some work there on Public Lands Day.
Your background is in archaeology. Give us a one-minute version of what you've been doing as an archaeologist on public lands.
Well, last year, we stabilized Fort Coso, which was a phenomenal building in the Coso Mountains. It has two huge chimneys. It may have been an army barracks associated with the Owens Valley Indian Wars, and we want to keep the rocks from falling down. So that was quite a job with a crane truck and a lot of dedicated volunteers. It's got archaeological deposits that would be interesting to study someday. You can't study them very well when everything falls down on the floors. So we stabilized that last year in Public Lands Day. And the reason we have Public Lands Day on a Navy station is because the land was withdrawn. It's public land withdrawn for military use for X number of years. If the Navy doesn't need it anymore, it could go back to becoming public lands again. So we are good stewards. The Navy is excellent stewards. They've only used 7% of the 1 million acres on the ground. So what we're trying to do is preserve stuff for the future, and we need the public's help to do so.
You've discussed the fact that there is an extraordinary collection of petroglyphs that you take the public on tours of. So this could be a grand addition to the general public lands legacy. Let's talk about September 29th. You're looking for a few good people to help you out, but it sounds so interesting. Why don't you tell us what you're up to?
What we need is a few people, and because this is a highly classified military base, they have to be American citizens and in good standing. We can't take children. They need to be at least, 16 years old, because we can't babysit, because we're working with heavy plywood. We're going to take five stone buildings, unmortared stone, and put plywood and bracing up on the inside and out of them and keep them from falling down. We're going to clean up some debris that's been there accumulating for the 60 years that the Navy has been on the base that we haven't cleaned it up. We're going to take and move some stuff around. We've got the 1960s photos. Some things have moved around a bit. We're going to try to put them back in place. And we're going to hammer, saw, nail, and stabilize the structures, is what it's called, so they don't fall down, kind of like we did last year at a site 3 miles away. This is a little village site, what it was. There were probably up to 200 people living there in the 1860s and 1870s. They came back in the Depression, so there's some Depression-era stuff, not a lot, but we want to keep this. This site is eligible for the National Register, and one of the significant parts of this is because it basically extols Mexican history, because they were Mexican miners that were finally absorbed by the rush of Americans coming from the South after the Civil War. But the Mexicans worked hard, found gold, found silver, and all the names in the local area are a Hispanic name. Some of the folks actually documented from Chile. So what we're trying to do is protect this as not an example of early American history, but as ethnic history, history of early California preserved on a naval station.
Fascinating. It sounds as if to head out there, hearing you talk about the history of this area would be fascinating all by itself. And I imagine you'd learn some interesting techniques of restoration that otherwise you might not know.
Yes, that's why we need some people. We need a few people just to pick up stuff and chop weeds and stuff, but mostly we need folks that can handle a hammer, handle a saw, you know, figure out how to stabilize it, move around some rocks and debris to keep the walls from falling down. We will tell stories. This was one of the last battles of the Owens Valley Indian Wars in 1865, 6, and 7. Happened in the vicinity. Some miners lost their lives in the battles here. They're probably located somewhere in the village. There's no headstones, no cemetery, but they certainly buried them where they fell. So it's a very precious place, too, for the fact that it was remote in the 1860s. It was part of Tulare County. It's now in Inyo County. Lots written about Cerro Gordo. Lots written about the mines in the vicinity. Very little written about this. Snippets. Close to Darwin, California, which a lot is written about Darwin.
Mm-hmm. Because this is in an area that typically is associated with plenty of heat, what should people be prepared to put up with?
Well, it's 5,500 feet elevation, so it's not as hot, but long sleeve shirts are required, long pants, no shorts, hat, gloves, lots of water.
Now, how about tools? Should people bring their own tools?
We'll have tools, but if they have portable saws, that are battery-operated saws that are recharged, we can use some of the rotary saws like that, yes.
And then how should people contact you? Because you're going to have to do a little screening, and also let's talk about where people would actually meet up and what they can expect to get into that zone there.
Okay, they'll have to contact me at area code 760-939-1350, and I'm out in the field a lot, so they'll have to leave me a message. I can only take X number of people. I've got about half of it filled up right now. They have to be American citizens in good standing. I think I might have said that. Even if they have a green card, they're not allowed because you're going through some very secure spaces. And since 9/11, we've had to really tighten up on security. No children. 16 years old is a cutoff. There's heavy equipment going to be up there to move stuff around, and we can't watch kids.
And where will people meet, and how will they get to the site?
Okay, people will call me, and I'll tell them where to meet. They'll meet in Ridgecrest, California. And they have to call me. I'll have to get them a badge to get onto the base. So I'll have to have their Social Security numbers, but don't leave that on my phone. I'll leave a phone number, and I will call you back.
This is what's so interesting about National Public Lands Days. There's such a diversity of things to do, and this sounds so fascinating. I may try to – well, I probably won't be able to make it up there.
Well,
you better not count on me, but I sure would like to be there. Hey, here's a question for you. If I love Google Earth. Is there – do you know – is there a way to kind of identify where this is so if people want
to just
kind of be there, even if they couldn't be there, they'd know where this is?
Yeah, just go to Darwin, California. Look for the town of Darwin. This is 6 miles southwest of the town of Darwin, and you'll see a little bitty bunch of little houses. Most of them no longer have roofs, and you'll see a water pond called Cold Coso Springs. It's listed on if you get a topo map of Coso, COSO, it's on the topo map.
Well, we're talking with Russell Kaldenberg, who is with the Naval Air Weapons Station, China Lake area. Russell, give your contact phone number again, and hopefully someone will give you a call.
760-939-1350, and just leave me a message, and I'll get back with you.
Great talking with you, Russell.
Thank you.
Now that's exciting. A bit north and east of China Lake is the Tahoe National Forest, where some lucky people can participate in serious fieldwork as part of National Public Lands Day. National Public Lands Day offers so many opportunities to people to get out into the wilds, into the backcountry very often, and do some terrific work for our public lands. If you go to publiclandsday.org, you're going to find hundreds and hundreds of events all over the country with great information about where things are, what's happening. There's some really unique opportunities, I think some really creative opportunities to use this time to get some unique forms of work done and to talk about a great opportunity. We're talking with David Michael, who's with the Tahoe National Forest out of Nevada City, California. David, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You are a U.S. Forest Service employee. Tell us about your role with the Forest Service.
Well, I am the Tahoe National Forest Trails and OHV Program Manager and have responsibilities for the overall program management on the Tahoe National Forest.
Why don't you give us a description of the Tahoe National Forest, just a little visual of kind of where it is and what people would expect to see if they go to Tahoe National Forest.
Tahoe National Forest is located east of Sacramento, California, in the area between Sacramento and Lake Tahoe, and it includes land on both the west side of the Sierra Crest as well as the east side, and it's got Interstate 80 running through the middle of it.
For National Public Lands Day, which is, again, September 29th, you have a very interesting opportunity for people to do something different than kind of weed whacking and repairing bridges and painting buildings and picking up trash. Tell us a little bit about what your plans are for National Public Lands Day. I think it's a very innovative way to involve the public in public lands.
Well, we've been working with a local group called Friends of Tahoe Access. This is a group of volunteers who belong to various off-highway vehicle clubs and organizations, and we're in the process of doing an environmental impact study on off-highway vehicle use on the forest. So there is a need to collect some information out in the field, and a lot of it requires specialized equipment to get back in on some of these four-wheel drive roads. And so we've formed a kind of a partnership with these volunteers to get that information for us.
What kind of a distance are people going to be traveling on their four-wheel drives to get to the site?
It's throughout the forest. There's a number of different sites. It's not so far back in. There's a lot of Forest Service roads that they can use to get into the more four-wheel drive areas. So it's not so much distance as it is once they get there, it's a real four-wheel drive experience when they're there. And, of course, then we have them looking for a number of things that we're concerned about.
Well, why don't you talk about what you're going to ask these people to do to help you with your EIS statement?
We have a lot of data that we collect in a geospatial information system, GIS system, which tracks all of the roads and so forth spatially, as well as a lot of tabular data that's collected on each one of those. And so what we're asking them to do is to verify the presence or absence, if we have a route shown on there, to verify that it is there, and then also to pick up and do a lot of photographic documentation of stuff along the route.
Now, what would you want them to be photographing?
Stream crossings, views of from photo points, so it would be a direction and a distance, establishing some photo points, and then from that stream crossing, because we're very interested in watershed quality, we want to have a good look at what that looks like. So we'll have to take pictures upstream, downstream, the approaches in and out. We're looking for erosion impacts. We're also looking for some of the social things, the dispersed sites that people may be camping along there, or vista points or points of interest.
It's like a survey of multiple different aspects of the areas that you're going to be looking at. In terms of what they should bring along besides their four-wheel drive, what should they be prepared to bring in?
One of the things that we're hoping to get together here, they all have to be under a volunteer agreement with us, so there's some paperwork that needs to be done. The other thing is that we are in the middle of fire restrictions here, so their vehicles have to pass a fire inspection, make sure mufflers and all that is in good working condition. They pair up with other club members or other groups, motorists, that have Forest Service radio access, so they're not just out there by themselves. So Forest basically is closed to off-highway vehicle travel at the moment because of the fire restrictions. So it's more like a guided little expedition in there to collect this information.
Now, in terms of equipment, do you provide some of that, or do they provide that themselves?
Well, generally, we've been training some team leaders so they know what we actually want. But there is a need for drivers. There is a need for some photography. It's quite slow, tedious work. It's not just a drive, on a nice four-wheel drive road. They're stopping often to take pictures and to document things. Mm-hmm. But they would need to, one, have a vehicle that would do that, get back in there. And then just, a digital camera, any type of, decent digital camera that can be downloaded and annotated as to what they actually took the pictures of.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's give some details. How long do you expect this to go on? And where do you plan to meet and what time?
We're going to meet here at the Nevada City office at the Forest Service, but we can only handle, a relatively small number. We're looking at maybe up to somewhere, certainly not to exceed 50 people. So what we're asking is that if people are interested, to simply notify myself as the contact person and see if there's still room available, on this project. Because it is, unlike other projects like, where you're just out there putting masses out, we have some pretty specialized things that we're looking for. So hopefully we can accommodate the people that are interested in doing it. And if not, we can accommodate them at another time, probably.
Can you give out some contact information?
Sure. My name is David Michael. That's M-I-C-H-A-E-L. I'm at the Tahoe National Forest in Nevada City, California. My email address is demichael@fs.fed, that's FED.US. And my phone number is area code 530-478-6183.
Well, it sounds like a great opportunity to, first of all, get out in areas that otherwise at this point are closed off and learn about being responsible with the four-wheel drives. And sounds like a great day.
We hope to have a great Public Lands Day. And encourage all those that are interested in attending our Tahoe National Forest Public Lands Day to contact me quickly so that we can see if there's still room available. And so give me a call. We'll see if we can accommodate you.
David Michael, I want to thank you so much, and we'll hope you have some great weather.
Thank you very much.
Now we head a bit farther north in California to the Redwood Country to see what people can do amongst the towering depths of the majestic redwoods. Today, as I've been focusing on National Public Lands Day, I've been kind of traveling around California, but the thing to remember is that there are events virtually in every state in the Union, hundreds and hundreds of events. There's a link on the website where you can go to publiclands.com. day.org. Find your state, and you will be surprised. In California, there must be 100 different events that are happening on public lands, all on public lands, on September 29th. Well, up in the Redwood Zone, where the grand, most extraordinary trees in the universe are still up there doing fine and celebrating the wonder, there's going to be a series of events, and to learn what people can do in that area, we're now talking with Michelle Luna. Michelle, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Michelle, you work with an organization called Stewards of the Redwoods, and it sounds as if it's kind of an activist organization, but actually it's quite a bit more than that. Why don't you talk about Stewards of the Redwoods and their relationship to California and their state parks?
Actually, our full name is Stewards of the Coast and Redwoods, because we support not only Redwood Parks, but we have a whole coastal area that we support as well. And we are a cooperative association with California State Parks. We work with the parks in the Russian River District, and that includes Armstrong Redwood State Reserve, and then Austin Creek State Recreation Area, which is above the reserve, and then all of Sonoma Coast State Park, which includes about 20 miles of coastline from north of Jenner down to Bodega Bay, and then inland, and it encompasses over 10,000 acres of land now. So that's kind of our geographic area, and we support volunteer programs, education, and stewardship programs in the park. So we have, about 15 different program activities that we do that range from staffing visitor centers to taking school groups out into the parks to learn about the redwoods and watersheds and tide pools and just a whole huge variety of things that we do to support our parks.
It's a whole area of public involvement with public lands that is a great opportunity for everybody, literally across the country. If you go to national parks, they have their cooperating associations. You'll find them running the bookstores and different concession stands in the parks. And in this case, with the California parks, that's exactly what you're doing as well. So if you visit a visitor center, you're being influenced by the work of Michelle and her organization. Well, Michelle, let's talk about National Public Lands Day, because we're doing kind of a survey of what people can do. Let's talk about some of the plans that you have for that Saturday.
Our current project is going to be at Armstrong Redwood State Reserve, and it's going to be a restoration effort. We have been restoring this old growth forest for quite a number of years in different ways. Also, the Fife Creek watershed, which is a salmon stream. So for us on Saturday the 29th, we are going to be replacing some of the fencing that was put up about, 10 years ago. And the fencing went up to keep park visitors on the trails so that the understory plants that are really essential for the growth of the redwoods would not get trampled. And, as wood decays, a lot of that fencing needs to be replaced now. So we are going to be working on that from about 9 to 1 on the 29th. And we're hoping that people will come out and meet in the front parking lot around 9 o'clock and join the crew and bring a lunch, some extra water, wear sturdy shoes, bring some gloves, and enjoy the camaraderie of everybody that's going to show up.
Now, how many people would you hope to have?
It would be nice to have a crew of about 25. I think that's kind of a doable project for us. If we get more than that, there's another potential project that could be happening around that time that has to do with some stream restoration that we're doing. We might expand and split the group up to do something else, but we're still trying to work that out right now, and I'm not sure if that project's going to have started by then. But there's definitely enough fencing that needs to replace to keep that number of people busy.
Now, how about kids and families and even elders? Are they will they be find things to do?
I think children would have a little bit more of a challenge with this project. However, we do fence building projects with school groups all the time. We do service learning projects, so some of the older children would be able to do that. And, we'll provide some education, so there would be some things for youngsters to do as well. Potentially some projects that they could, ways that they can learn about redwood ecology and why we're doing what we're doing.
Right. Well, this really is an intention to get something done, so you don't want to have, you do plenty of educational outreach. That will happen, but this really is a work party, so it's not designed to just go out there and have just a good time. Really, you need some people who are dedicated to getting things done.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Now, they show up and give us a sense of kind of what happens then. Do they walk into the site or along a trail, or what happens?
Well, it just kind of depends. We want everyone to meet in the front parking lot so we can get people checked in. There's, you know, a little bit of paperwork that gets done with state parks to sign people up as volunteers in parks for the day. And then because I think some of the projects going to help happen towards the back of the park, we make carpool up to the front, and then we will get people situated. We've got crew leaders that will have everything laid out, so it'll be easy for people just to kind of start off and embark on the project.
I think you're past your mosquito season at this point, aren't you, or not?
Well, yeah, because the stream, there's not any water currently in the stream, so the mosquitoes are definitely better. However, it's not a bad idea to have people bring repellent if they feel they need to. They won't be in an area where there's poison oak. If we were out in the backcountry, that would be a concern. But that shouldn't be a problem in this location.
Mm-hmm. Well, if people want to find out how to contact you, what's the best way to do so?
Oh, they can call our office at area code 707-869-9177. And they can also email us at stewards, which is stewards, at mcn.org.
Terrific. Well, I hope the weather's good and you get a full crew out there to help you restore some fencing on National Public Lands Day.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, Michelle. Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye.
I'm sure by now you'll want to see what's happening in your neck of the woods, our streams, prairies, and seashores. There are hundreds of events that will give you an exciting day outdoors, being a real part of the stewardship that comes with living in a free society. To find out what's happening near you, go to www.publiclandsday.org, publiclandsday.org, and follow the links to events happening in your state. And a reminder, with all that's happening on this, our grand earth, I invite you to share your voice on the weekly Earth Summit. So send me an email, send it to wildsidenews@cox.net. That's WILDSIDENEWS at COX.net with your name and phone number. And I'll call you and we'll talk. And there's a good chance you too can add your voice to the voice of the earth, which is heard each Thursday or anytime on the archives. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again here on the Wild Side News.